there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and live in person answers to your questions, both phone and email. So stay tuned for an hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I had some interesting emails the last couple of weeks and haven't had a chance to go to them, so I'm going to do some emails to start with. So first email comes from Rob in South Africa, and I always love it when I get calls, or rather emails, from across the globe. Dear Dr. Dawn, I've been following your podcast for about 2 years and find them extremely informative. Thank you for your time. I would be grateful for your comments on the following. Background, I'm going to skip over a little bit. This is a 66-year-old male born and bred in South Africa. He's from Caucasian European stock. At the age of 26, he became allergic to red meat. In this category are all forms of meat, including beef, lamb, pork, and venison. Also, any dried meat. Prior to this, he'd had a lot of that in his diet, but he can eat seafood, forms of birds, fowl of all kinds, and he does have other allergies such as penicillin, sulfa, cat hair, and other types of what we would call IgE-mediated allergies. Then he goes on to describe his reaction. About 6 hours after eating, he will develop hives, vomiting, diarrhea, and low blood pressure, including having passed out on several occasions. Recently, he had pork sausage and his breathing was affected, meaning he had wheezing. As soon as I have a reaction, I take an antihistamine and some steroids, cortisone, and this sorts it out. But what I've found is if I have, say, a pork chop or some other meat, occasionally I'll have no reaction. However, if I begin to have it on a more regular basis, there is a reaction. It's as if there is a buildup of toxins and then the reaction starts. Recently, a friend of mine, also of 60, became food intolerant to red meat. It was only because of my affliction she was able to pick up the problem quickly. Apart from the two of us, I've not come across anyone with the same problem. Well, Rob, thank you very much for a very good opening to talk about the different kinds of food sensitivities that there are, because I think that's a very poorly understood thing. And if you really want to make an allergist or a regular doctor angry, tell them you have a food allergy, because they will tell you how rare food allergies are and la la la. And then they'll blood test you for IgE and tell you you don't have a food allergy. And that's because of a narrow use of the word allergy. So I'm going to broaden the use of the word so as not to dismay and infuriate my medical colleagues and say that there are a range of different food sensitivities, some of which are actually allergic and IgE mediated. What Rob is describing is IgE mediated, and the reason I can say that is because he describes hives and also wheezing and also hypotension or low blood pressure passing out. In that type of hypersensitivity reaction, the mast cells in the intestines, which are a type of immune cell covered with little IgE receptors for particular proteins, and these IgE are an immunoglobulin, displayed on the outside of the cell, kind of like a pincushion, if you imagine, or a sea urchin. And whenever an antigen, a protein, that matches the barcode, let's call it, on the spine of the sea urchin attaches, you have the potential for an allergic reaction. If it attaches to two of the spines, then that cell, the mast cell, is going to degranulate, which means it's going to release little Ziploc packets of histamine and leukotrienes and slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis and a whole bunch of other irritants like bradykinin and squirt them into the general tissue around that cell. What that causes is immediate capillary leakage, and that leads to swelling and redness and what we call a hive, itching, because of the histamine and the bradykinin. And that vascular permeability, that capillary leakage, if it gets really intense, you drop your blood pressure because all of your serum in your bloodstream is trying to migrate out into your interstitial tissue. And this can be a fatal reaction. So this naturally is where conventional medicine has put its focus, on that kind of allergy, because that's the what will kill the patient. An appropriate emphasis, I might add. Now, there are other types of food sensitivity. There is IgG-mediated, where a person has circulating antibodies not attached to the mast cells. And this is not so dangerous. You're not going to drop your blood pressure and go into shock from this. You may get skin rashes like eczema. You may get a stuffy nose. You may get achy joints. You may just feel yucky. And you can have all sorts of intestinal reactions, including, I might add, a great many cases of quote-unquote irritable bowel syndrome are actually due to this type of food sensitivity. But because the reaction is delayed, sometimes by hours, sometimes by days, it's much harder to pin down. This type of food sensitivity is something that I'll often do blood testing for. And like I said, don't go to an allergist if you think you have this, because it is by definition not an allergy, and it won't show up on allergy skin testing, and it won't show up on IgE blood testing. So it's very, very important to understand the distinction. And then there's the food intolerances that are related to an inability to digest a certain food. A classic example of this would be lactose intolerance, where when a person eats dairy, they lack sufficient enzymes to break down milk sugar, and so they'll get gas and diarrhea and cramping and all sorts of gastrointestinal reactions. So that, in a nutshell, Rob, is the situation. Why you develop this? Well, typically IgE responses develop because a person has, well, let's just say, biological settings from infancy that predispose them to this type of sensitivity. Lots of antibiotics in childhood. Not breastfeeding, but bottle feeding. These are two risk factors for this. A family history of allergy or asthma, also a very strong risk factor. And I'd be willing to bet as an infant that you had eczema. You could ask your mom if she's still around and remembers. But in any event, there is actually a treatment for Rob that might be helpful. And that treatment is the use of high doses of probiotics. In particular, the probiotic Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which is R-H-A-M, and then forget it, I can't spell it. The spelling on that is Lactobacillus rhamnosus, R-H-A-M-N-O-S-U-S. Thank you, Charlie. Anyway, that form of Lactobacillus has been shown in scientific studies to reduce the Th2 hypersensitivity reaction and balance it out with the Th1. So it reduces allergies. It's been shown to reduce eczema in children. It's been shown to help with asthma attacks. And I would anticipate that it might make Rob less sensitive. One last thing. The phenomenon he reports of being able every now and then to get a pork chop by without having a reaction has to do with a sort of down regulation over time with allergic symptoms. And those of you who have seasonal rhinitis, hay fever, or cat allergy may notice this. I can describe the cat allergy phenomenon because I am allergic to cats. And when I encounter a cat, if I haven't been around one for quite some time or in a household that has cats, I'm just fine. My nose doesn't run. My eyes don't itch. I've got a couple of hours before my antibodies seem to wake up and start reacting. But if I am in that house for several days as a guest, if I am around that cat every day, even in small doses, gradually my sensitivity will start to amp up until I'm on a hair trigger. And anyone who's ever suffered from hay fever without treatment for a 6-week pollen cycle knows that the symptoms amplify and they get worse and worse and worse and worse. And that brings us, I think, to the end of the first segment. So good luck to you, Rob. Another email that we got this week that I thought was especially good to talk about was from Mary in El Paso, Texas. Dear Dr. Don, your show was right on target for me. About a month ago, I began Qigong classes to manage fibromyalgia and joint problems. One of the first lessons the instructor taught us was how to stand correctly. He emphasized that the shoulders must be kept open, not closely connected to the body. I learned when reaching that I was keeping my shoulders tight and stretching with my whole torso. Now, I know to separate my arm and stretch my arm away from the body. This is wordy so I can be clear. The teacher talked about how many problems with the rotator cuff or other injuries are caused from tight shoulders. On another subject you covered on the 4th, I have a friend who is taking the Qigong class to help with her panic attacks while driving. She's also been taking a low dose of Elavil, but already feels more improvement after a month of Qigong. I should say that my Qigong teacher Stephen Borofsky places much emphasis on breathing and on the meditative quality of this work, with the body always flowing smoothly. And she gives a website, and the website I have not checked out yet, so I will post it if I agree that it's a good source. Mary, thank you for bringing up Qigong. I am a practitioner, just a learner on that, and I have found it enormously helpful for calming myself down and also just improving my ability to get through a difficult or stressful day at the office. I always try to do it, particularly on my call days when I'm, by the nature of the work I do, battered from the death of 1,000 paper cuts with interruptions and questions. And unfortunately, any single one of these interruptions could be life-threatening, so they're very alerting. But at the same time, most of them are trivial and they interrupt my flow of thought. So they become cumulatively throughout the day quite stressful. That cumulative stress is something that the Qigong seems to help with. I think that might be why it's helping your friend with the panic attacks. And I certainly suggest to anyone who suffers from chronic anxiety, try taking a Qigong or a Tai Chi class and doing a regular practice. Just 15 minutes a day can make a huge difference, and it's not such a big investment in time. Let's go to the phones, and we're talking to Mark in La Selva. Hello, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, I have a follow-up question on the IgE and IgG. Is that correct?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been battling Lyme disease for 5 years, and I'm wondering if there's a way to differentiate between a Herxheimer reaction and maybe an IgG reaction to the drugs taken for a long period of time, or if that even happens, if an IgG reaction happens with the drugs or can when you're battling Lyme.
The antibiotics themselves, I presume those are the drugs you're referring to.
Yeah, and some even herbal formulas, like Artemisia and some powerful herbal.
Right, and those have liver toxicity, so they're definitely potentially can cause a reaction. Okay, that's a complicated question. Let's start with peeling the onion. Can you develop an IgG reaction to drugs? Maybe. IgG reactions can occur to biological substances. In fact, if you look up serum sickness, S-E-R-U-M, you'll find that was a fairly common biological reaction that occurred in the early days of immunization when we used to make our vaccines, not growing them cloned in vats with yeast, but instead injecting the substance into horses or pigs and then extracting it from the blood of these animals after they formed antibody. So serum sickness is against the protein in the horse or the pig, respectively. And if a drug contained a large enough protein moiety, as it's called, theoretically at least you could develop an IgG reaction. That being said, I've never actually heard of such a thing in either the functional medical literature or the conventional medical literature. So I think it must be quite rare. There are so many other ways that antibiotics could cause you to feel badly and mimic an IgG reaction that I think I'd look elsewhere. For starters, I'd look in the intestines, because if you're taking large doses of antibiotics, you are de facto messing with your internal ecology, including your gut flora. And so a very strong preservation program is in order in anyone who has to fight Lyme disease with long-term high-dose antibiotics or antibacterials. With respect to the Herxheimer reaction, just let me define that. Herxheimer reaction is at a point when you have a large die-off, usually of yeast. In fact, I think it may be almost exclusively referring to a yeast die-off in the intestine. All the bodies of the yeast break down and are released, at least to a certain extent, into the bloodstream, compounds which make you feel sick, like a flu-like illness. And I have definitely seen people that I put on an elimination diet, which means they're not getting any sugar and they're not getting much starch, have a flu-like illness for a couple of days. People who go on an Atkins diet will often experience that as well, because they've eliminated all carbohydrate. It is implicitly, in my opinion, tells me that this person had some yeast overgrowth, which may or may not have been causing the quote-unquote yeast syndrome. I still think that that's a misinterpretation of the data, the so-called yeast syndrome. Although there truly are people who have a lot of candida, I think they've also got a lot of other things growing in there that shouldn't be, and I'm not sure we can attribute their problems directly to the candida. But that's, you know, a larger debate than we can cover here. As far as your Lyme disease goes, sometimes the cure is worse than the disease. And
I know that all too well.
Yeah. So unless you're having ongoing progressive deterioration, like big-time rheumatological findings or multiple sclerosis like neuritis-type syndromes, it might be nice to just take a drug holiday for a week or two, or maybe a month, and just stop everything and eat a nice, healthy diet and lots of probiotics and try to restabilize the system.
Yeah, I do that.
Good.
Yeah.
I think a break every now and then is a good idea. And I'm nervous about the treatment, the aggressive treatment of Lyme disease, because it is sort of like treating the fleas by burning down the house.
Right, shotguns.
Yeah, a little overly aggressive, maybe. I hope that answers your question.
Somewhat.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Bye-bye. Let's talk to Marianne in Felton. Hello, Marianne, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm feeling a lot better. Yesterday I had a colonoscopy, 52, and I didn't do it because I had any problems. It's just that it was a prescribed thing to do after 50.
Right.
And I was happy and sad at the same time.
Well, you were happy and sad. Did you have any polyps?
No, none whatsoever. I got an A+. And so I was just wondering, because I know colonoscopies pretty much take away your floras and all your good stuff in your intestines.
Well, no, they don't. They don't take away your flora. What they do is that you take an osmotic cathartic, which means pulls a lot of water from your bloodstream into your colon and doesn't let it back out again. So it sort of washes everything out. But it's not toxic particularly. It doesn't kill your flora. So in general, it removes all of your stool. But you still have plenty of flora left over in there that will repopulate. Most of your poop, you know, it's residue of the food you eat, but something like 50% of it is just exfoliated cells from your colon.
Ah, okay.
And so that'll replenish itself. Even if you didn't eat, it'll replenish itself in a few days.
Oh.
And there's plenty of bacteria there, so it'll just recede rather quickly.
Okay, because I was thinking, what would be a good first meal to have after that?
Oh, whatever you like to eat, assuming you don't have any food intolerances, I should think that you just go back to whatever you like.
All right.
Maybe push the soluble fiber. You know, if you want to speed the process up, throw some flaxseed in there. That's a good source. Jerusalem artichoke, if you can find it, but basically flaxseed's a good source.
Okay. Yeah, because I just thought that it kills all of that off and that you need to do probiotics. So.
No, if you've got a good colony of bowel flora to start with, it'll repopulate.
Good. Well, I feel a lot better then.
What made you sad about the colonoscopy?
Because I thought it killed that all off.
Well,
I've been asking, and everyone said yes.
No, I disagree. You should repopulate just fine.
Yeah, and in the middle of the day yesterday, I had a really bad bout of, I guess, the bloating cramps.
But that was after your colonoscopy.
Right.
Let me tell you, when we do colonoscopy, we put a lot of air into your intestine. And although we try to suck it out as we come back out the other day, if you're really polite, you do a lot of sucking because you don't want your patient to have too much cramping afterwards. However, you get to places where when you try to suck, the bowel wall just gets sucked right up against the opening.
Right.
And so you have to leave a bubble of gas there because you just can't get it out.
Right. Okay. Well, good.
Take a long walk.
Yes, that's what I'm doing today.
Good.
Yesterday, I just didn't feel good enough to do that. So.
Yeah. Take a long walk today. You'll be as good as new tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I guess I should have said to Marianne, and I will say it because I'm sure she's still listening, that in the 24 hours after a colonoscopy, if the cramping and bowel tenderness gets worse and you start having progressively more cramping, it's very important to be checked out for a occult perforation of the bowel. This only occurs very rarely, once perhaps every 2,000 or 3,000, figures vary, of course, on this. But if this happens and there's a little leak from the inside of the intestine, you can develop peritonitis and you need to be in the hospital on antibiotics and no food should that occur. Usually heals itself, rarely requires surgery, but it does require management. So increasing pain after 24 hours, big red flag, get an x-ray. And the x-ray would show air where there shouldn't be, and then you know you've got a perforation. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Henry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Henry, and welcome
Hello.
To the program. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a 59-year-old, and I'm having a problem with one of my fingers. I'm getting a myxoid cyst, and it gets drained and then refills and drains and refills and drains. One doc says go to a rheumatologist. One says ignore it. One says inject cortisone. I don't know what to do. It keeps coming back.
Okay. How many times has you had it drained?
At least 3 or 4.
Okay. It's wanting to come back.
And
yeah. Is this a finger that has any kind of unusual activity, like you do target practice and it's your trigger finger or anything? Where?
No, I also have a problem with chilblains in the wintertime.
Okay. Don't know if there's a direct reaction, but the myxoid cyst is probably filled with something resembling synovial fluid, and so it's close to a ganglion in terms of its manifestations.
Uh-huh.
Depending on which school of thought, I mean, you've basically described the 3 standard responses. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Leave it alone, forget it, ignore it, which, if that's feasible, I think is a good strategy. You suck it out and steroid it, suck it out and steroid it. You know, I'll do that maybe twice on something, and then you've come back more than that. So that's not going to work. Removal, surgical removal, also an option, only worthwhile if it's bothering you.
I see.
Getting into alternative, now taking off the white coat and putting on my acupuncture belt, I will tell you that that's a manifestation of coagulation of the chi in that meridian.
Uh-huh.
And so an acupuncturist might look at your overall health picture and check your pulses and say, which finger is it, by the way?
The middle finger of the right hand.
Middle finger of the right hand. So they might say you have a problem with flow in the triple burner.
Mm-hmm.
And they might treat that particular meridian and try to fix things. Or they might find that you have other physical problems, like perhaps, let's say, TMJ, or a certain pattern of headache that would be characteristic, or shoulder pain that would be characteristic of problems in that meridian, and they might find, in fact, that that's just a symptom of a meridian problem. I usually will look when someone has something like that. I'll ask them some questions that just, okay, am I getting red flags for that meridian?
Mm-hmm.
And if I am, then maybe I'll suggest they get acupuncture for it.
Okay. So any supplements that would be helpful?
None that I know of.
Okay.
None that I know of. I had one in the palm of my hand, and I went to a Korean acupuncturist at a convention. I thought, well, you know, what the heck, you know, and it's one of those big trade show things. So I'm sitting there, and he says, oh, yes, well, this is, you know, this is congestion in the liver, and I don't, I'm listening, you know, listening and learning. Then he treated it by taking this little roller thing with prongs on it and just ramming the hell out of it with that just really hard. It hurt like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It went away, and it comes back periodically, and all I have to do is push on it and it disappears and stays gone for a couple of days. So he manifestly altered its natural history, whether it was liver congestion or whether he just, you know, opened up the drainage channel by wailing on it so hard. I entertained both hypotheses in my mind, and I haven't really noticed a change in my liver.
Yeah, because the dermatologist did say to kind of squeeze on it and like squeeze it back into the system, and I didn't have any success with that.
Yeah, I think you have to push really hard. So I guess where I'm going with this is if you can seek out a Korean hand acupuncturist and get that therapy anecdotally, completely, mine disappeared that way.
Got it. Okay.
Do you care? Do you need
to?
Well,
I guess I'm just, you know, is it something not to worry about?
It's not like the early warning sign of some terrible disease.
Got it. Okay.
So if it's just that you're worried about what it might mean, you can hang that one up on the wall and
forget. Got it. And don't go through the rheumatologist and all their tests.
No, not unless you get a whole bunch of them on a whole bunch of fingers.
Got it. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. And let's go to Beulah in Carmel. Hello, Beulah. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just hearing the lady talking about the colonoscopy.
Yes.
And I thought it might be worth telling something. I had a colonoscopy 2 years or so ago, and I put off a lot of people from doing it because for a year afterwards, I would have a perfectly good bowel movement in the morning and then about half an hour later get diarrhea day after day after day. It finally went away. So I was, you know, really against having this ever done again. And I wondered if any of your people, if you or any of your listeners, had watched Dr. Oz's program this week.
No.
He had them film himself having a colonoscopy.
Yes.
And they found a little tiny pink polyp, and they snipped it. And it was, in fact, cancerous. And it would have taken about 10 years, and he would have had colon cancer.
Yes.
And so I thought it was worth, you know, feeling that I'd sort of put some people off, it was worth mentioning this to encourage people to have this done.
I have to say that the reaction that you're describing is not one that I've ever heard before, and I have to say that my patients as a group are not people who are hesitant to complain. So I think it must be quite unusual.
Yes, I did all kinds of things, couldn't find out why, but it finally went away. So now I feel that I, you know, owe the world some encouragement for colonoscopy, having discouraged it for a while.
Well, thank
you. It was fascinating to see this. It was just this pretty little tiny pink thing.
Little, yes, and you don't even know when you take it out as a physician whether it's going to be cancerous or dysplastic. Well, interestingly enough, a little story about this. About 1970, we started doing flexible sigmoidoscopies, and there was a movement in medicine called family practice, and they were training. The old general practitioner had gotten more skills, and that was a family physician. And one of the things they were trained to do was these half colonoscopies, basically the first half, the lower bit. And that's where most cancers occurred. In the 1970s, 70% of colon cancers were in the final 30 inches, basically, of the colon. Mm. And that was an area that was relatively safe to go after, not so much training, instruments were not too expensive. So Kaiser started doing it, and other entities started funding it. And what happened over the course of the next 25 years was that the percentage of colon cancers that occurred in the lower half of the colon dwindled from 70% to less than 40%, because we basically chased the cancers north, so to speak, higher up in the colon. We found all of the ones, or many of the ones, that would have gone on over 5 to 10 years and become cancerous and removed them. But because this particular procedure only went to the lower part of the colon, there was no way to get the ones that were higher. And so over time, the idea that if you found something in the lower colon, then that person should have the full colon evaluated grew up. And then later on, it became, well, why don't we just cut to the chase and do the full colon on everyone? And what this has led to kind of is that gastroenterologists are now just flooded with colonoscopies, and pretty much that's all they have time to do. And we've created kind of a monster in terms of everyone having to get a colonoscopy, and a lot of the complications do occur. On the other hand, we do prevent cancers. So it's a very complex and interesting issue trying to sort out, do we really want to go after all these cancers at the 10-year before they're cancer, or would there be a way to wait until they become cancer and then go do the colonoscopy and remove them before they spread? And there are some very new technologies which have yet to be proven but are commercially available. The problem is they're not covered by insurance, so they're not making much progress into the mainstream. But there is a DNA test which looks at the stool and tests for a DNA that is only found in cancer cells, essentially. Or I should say an RNA, a manifestation of DNA. So you only see copies of this particular marker in cancer cells. It's never made in a normal colon cell. So if you go hunting for it with a probe and you find it in the stool, you know somewhere in that person there's a cancer in the colon. So that's the guy you send for colonoscopy. That would be perhaps a strategy that we'll see emerging once we get national health.
I think that I have had that done. I sent in stool samples.
Probably not. Probably what they were looking for in your stool samples was hemoglobin, which is blood.
Okay.
And while cancers do bleed, other things can bleed as well. So that has a higher false positive rate.
This one's looking for DNA.
Okay. If you had the DNA test, then you actually did have the test I'm talking about. And that's really very forward-looking of your doctor.
That would be, yes.
Yes.
That was why I was going to call. Was calling originally before I heard this lady talking, and your producer answered it for me. We were looking for functional medicine people in the Monterey Peninsula area, and he told me to go on the web, but there's nothing, no one available there in that field.
In Monterey, I'm not aware of anyone, although if there is somebody out there who's doing functional medicine in Monterey, please call me and let me know where you are, because I hear this question a lot. Anyway, have a great day, Bilal.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And before we go to the next caller. I want to tell you about a genuine breakthrough. This is important, and I always want to be sure that we're on top of that. One of our big challenges is tuberculosis. With the global AIDS epidemic, we've had a large pool of people who are co-infected with both HIV and tuberculosis. And as you might imagine, it's harder to clear TB when you have an immune deficiency syndrome. And one of the great challenges has been that because antibiotics are often available without a prescription and are given because they're expensive at lower doses or for a lower than recommended amount of time, the tuberculosis that's out there has had the opportunity to become drug resistant. Here's the rub, folks. Tuberculosis grows very slowly in the petri dish or the test tube. So if I have, let's say, a strep infection, I can take that strep bacterium, I could put it on a gelatin plate, and within 2 days, I will know whether that strep is resistant to the antibiotics that I put on little paper discs and drop into that plate. I'll know that without a shadow of a doubt, and I could say, okay, that's antibiotic resistant, I have to change antibiotics. Tuberculosis, on the contrary, grows very slowly. So instead of 2 days, let's call it 60 days before I'll know that my TB is resistant to the drug I've been taking for 2 months. This is no way to run an airline. So we have been looking for rapid testing for drug resistance, and something that's cheap and quick and can be done in the field is the holy grail here. So researchers reporting in September 9th, New England Journal of Medicine, have a rapid molecular test, an automated test, that will find rifampin resistance. This is a really significant breakthrough, and the testing itself is immunested real-time. It's a polymerase chain reaction assay. So they amplify a particular gene that is associated with rifampin resistance. The system itself makes many, many, many copies of this gene such that it can be identified using an immuno kind of ELISA reaction. In other words, immune antibodies that will carry a fluorescence and attach to this amplified DNA and say, here I am, it's positive in this specimen. So this allows a very rapid identification. And we're talking about a lead time in this study of less than 2 hours from the moment the specimen is collected to when they have it available. This is something you might be able to package and take out to a field. Certainly, this is something that would give us a, let's call it a 48-hour turnaround time in the United States or other industrialized or urban nations where you have good transport. This is a very, very big and important step, and I'm pleased to see this technology. Wanted to be sure you heard it here first and understood its importance. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Susan in Monterey. Susan, thanks for waiting.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for taking my call. I talked to you about my PDD, and you advised me to walk, but my knees have gotten so weak I have almost buckled a few times. But the thing I'm calling about now is that last week or maybe 2 weeks, I've lost all track of time, I was having very deep heart pains in my chest, and I was terrified, and I went to the emergency room. Well, they took a bunch of tests, and he said it wasn't my heart. It turns out, he said, well, you're anemic, and they wanted to give me a transfusion, but I just don't like transfusions. I have personal reasons for not taking them.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to, enhance my diet with supplements and so on. But the problem is the pain that I was troubled with that took me into the emergency room was like this band around my midriff, mm-hmm. like a tight corset, if you will.
Just on the left side?
No, it's all around.
Both sides?
Both sides.
All right, go ahead.
And it's kind of like a numbness that I move my right arm and I put pressure on it and there's a pain there. And I did some reading, and I have had problems before with, I can't think of the name of that. Maybe you can help me.
You mean like shingles?
Shingles, yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Right.
Not to this degree, though.
Okay. A couple of things, Susan, before we go further. I didn't want to lose track of them because I've got them, they're floating in my head right now. First one is, when you're anemic and there's no understanding of why you're anemic, one of the things that has to be checked is whether or not you have colon cancer. Because the most common way that people over 50 present with colon cancer is unexplained anemia. So I'm not trying to scare you or anything, but it has to be established that you're not losing blood in your poop microscopically and not detecting it. So important.
Well, I've been anemic a lot before.
Okay, that's fine, but I just,
just get tested.
That should be investigated because it's so common. And if you're refusing a transfusion, if they're offering it, then you've got a significant anemia. And there may be a lot of reasons for that that it will take a blood specialist to sort out. But one of the things is ruling out that you have what we call occult loss of blood somewhere. Maybe you're not making it, or maybe you're making it just fine, but losing it. You have a leaky bucket, so to speak. So that's important. The other thing is with respect to chest pain being due to shingles, if it's on just one side of your body, I would buy that as common, likely, probable. But if it's going all the way around and it's all the way around your torso, then I worry about a couple of other things. One of the things would be, it sounds like you're over 60 from your voice, and there's something called a thoracic compression fracture. That can happen from coughing or sneezing or just spontaneously. And when that happens, it can pinch the nerves that go under the rib on both sides. That pain will tend to go all the way around, and it will tend to be both-sided. So I would be wanting to have them look very carefully at a bone x-ray of your back. And when they did the x-ray in the emergency room, they may have done a chest x-ray and done it to look at, you know, for pneumonia. And there may have been a little collapse fracture there, which, because the radiologist wasn't really thinking about chest pain, because the doctor wrote rule out pneumonia on the clinical information, the radiologist may not have mentioned it, or he may have mentioned it in his description but not in the final report, and the emergency room doctor may have only looked at the final report, or may in fact have looked at the film itself and the final report came in 2 days later and he never even saw it. So I would get a hold of those films, the actual physical films, and look at the report and maybe take those to your primary care doctor and say, you know, could there be a collapse fracture causing this pain?
Am I eligible to demand those from the hospital?
What is typical is that your doctor can get the actual hard copies of the films just by requesting them. And
so I have to find a primary care doctor first.
Don't you have a primary care doctor?
No, I do not.
Well, you should have a primary care doctor, because trying to get good quality medical care from an emergency room is a mistake. With all due respect to emergency rooms, they lack the key feature of good medical care, which is continuity. They're there for emergencies. They're there to pinch hit in a crisis. But when it comes to solving problems or keeping a person with multiple medical problems, such as anemia and pain, healthy, they can't do the job. They're not set up for it.
So my first step then should be to locate a doctor with whom I'm comfortable. And
exactly. You need a primary care doctor. You need to kind of come in with the list of the things you know that are wrong.
Yeah.
And first of all, give them a chance to kind of give you the once-over, get you into their heads, and don't flood them with 16 problems all at once. Say, I've got this, 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 no. this, and this, but what I'm here for you to help me with is this today. I want help with this pain. You know, that's the suggestion I'm making.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I guess you have a right to interview doctors as well. So
yes, you do.
It's okay to ask questions. Because my last doctor that was primary care, I won't mention any names or anything, but I was very uncomfortable.
You know, it's absolutely true that sometimes how could someone not love me? But you know, sometimes I do not get along with patients, and we agree that they will find another doctor and I will find another patient, because you have to have...
Yeah, that happens. Maybe it's because I look like the picture of health. Just this PDD and the thing, you know, and that's troubling me now. But otherwise, I'm happy. I feel, well, I'm rather energetic still.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate your concern. I guess it's okay to interview doctors just like you.
Exactly.
I appreciate your time, and you've been there for me, and you've given me good advice, and I appreciate it.
You need a local primary care doctor. That's the advice for today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Dunn. I'm concerned about ibuprofen and high blood pressure. I haven't had high blood pressure, but I have been taking ibuprofen off and on. I really like it. It helps with all sorts of problems, and I've been having some, I have plantar fasciitis, so I've been taking a lot to get my heel pain down. And I've been doing a little reading, and I didn't realize that it was tied to high blood pressure or that it can actually give you high blood pressure, and now I'm kind of nervous.
Well, let's start with mechanism. The reason that ibuprofen is associated with high blood pressure is because it causes fluid retention. So if a person has a latent hypertension, so their blood pressure is normal, but they don't have the, let's put it this way, they don't have the autoregulatory mechanisms healthy. Think of a car driving along on the freeway at 55 miles per hour. It's just fine. But if you were to hit the accelerator, it wouldn't accelerate smoothly. And if you were to hit the brake, it wouldn't be able to brake smoothly. That's what latent hypertension is. It's a person who looks just fine running along at 55, but throw a curveball at them, throw some fluid retention into the mix, for example, and their blood pressure will go up. So it's not really causing the hypertension as much as it's uncovering the latent hypertension. So if you take ibuprofen and you get fluid retention and you're latent hypertensive, your blood pressure will go up. If your body has the balance, the autoregulatory mechanisms to deal with the fluid retention, then what will happen is your kidneys will simply amplify up the fluid loss and balance it out for you, and your blood pressure will remain the same. So it depends on the individual. It's not as if it's giving you high blood pressure. Now, over time, large doses of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, and I'm talking about 2,000-3,000 milligrams a day in the case of ibuprofen, do stress the kidneys. And once the kidneys become stressed and start to deteriorate, then you become latent hypertensive, and then the whole thing is a vicious cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be also, once you're latent hypertensive, too much salt will cause you to have high blood pressure as well, because it causes fluid retention.
Okay.
So in terms of how you use your ibuprofen, if you're taking, say, 800 milligrams, 1,600 milligrams every single day, that's...
Okay, a pill is 200 milligrams?
Yeah, so that's 4 to 8 pills a day.
Okay.
If you were taking that much ibuprofen for 5 or 10 years, you might damage your kidneys.
Okay.
To put it in proportion. And we actually know these because before we had the Enbrels and the other disease-modifying agents for rheumatoid arthritis, we had the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, and people with RA would take 12 ibuprofen a day, every day, for 5 years. And then over that period of time, we would monitor their kidneys because we wanted to be sure at the first sign of kidney damage that we found them a different drug, put them on steroids or whatever, because we had a limited number of things to do. And we were always balancing that risk-benefit.
Okay.
So if your use is more casual than that, the major concern I have about the ibuprofen is that you not damage your intestines with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means taking it with food.
Right, I do that.
And being sure that if you develop any GI upset at all, you stop taking it for a while.
Okay.
All right. The other thing, we talked earlier in the program, much earlier, if you were listening, about this food sensitivity issue.
I heard some of it, but not all of it.
Well, there is a statistical correlation between regular use of ibuprofen and the development of food sensitivity. And one hypothesis of what that is about is that because the ibuprofen kind of damages the intestinal wall, the mechanism for that I'll come back to in a second, but because that happens, a person's more vulnerable to developing food sensitivity. So I'm saying that, what do you do to avoid getting food sensitivity? You eat a large variety of foods, and you make sure that you include probiotics in your diet, and you make sure that you don't overuse nonsteroidals. If you already have a bunch of food sensitivities, then I try not to get you to take nonsteroidals like ibuprofen, because I'm afraid it'll get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing comes without some kind of cost, but overall I think that moderate use, which I would define as not daily and not exceeding 800 milligrams per day, is unlikely to cause any kind of problems for a person.
Okay, then my other question about that if I take ibuprofen, would I see, like if I took my blood pressure before and after, would there be any change?
No, it'd be a couple of days. What we typically see is someone starts ibuprofen, let's say they sprain their ankle, and they have normal blood pressure on Monday when they start it, and Wednesday or Thursday they've retained enough fluid for you to start to see their blood pressure go up.
Uh-huh.
So it's several days of use before that's apparent.
Okay, because I have noticed that the last few times I've gone to the doctor, and I don't go to the doctor very often, that my blood pressure is higher than it used to be, and my doctor's never said anything about it, and I started checking it at Long's.
Yes.
But it was really weird because when I went in for like weeks, I would check it, you know, a couple times when I was there, and it was lower than normal. And then 1 week, it was like way higher than normal. And that was independent of anything I was doing, I think.
I think you need to buy a cuff.
Uh-huh.
And they run, you know, with the rebate, they run like $30.
Oh, that's not bad.
So just get yourself a cuff. Costco has a good one. And monitor your blood pressure. It's usually highest in the morning, so check a morning blood pressure, and maybe once or twice a week.
Uh-huh.
And then if you want to do the experiment with the ibuprofen, don't take it for a week and check your blood pressure. Having checked it a couple of times a week, don't take the ibuprofen. Take Tylenol for a couple weeks and monitor the blood pressure and see if you see much of a variation.
Okay, so a week would be a good slacking off.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. Well, I will do that. Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye. You too. Bye.
So I have another email here, this one from Frank in Pacific Grove. Listening to your show about palliative care last week, and I have a related question. My father has, among other things, COPD. He's starting to receive some in-home care from Kaiser, with hospice being the next stage, as I understand it. He's already had the protocol of interventions. In other words, there's nothing else his doctors can do. But recently I read about a treatment called nebulized NAC, the glutathione precursor and antioxidant. Do you know anything about this treatment? Is the inhaled solution available? I don't want to take up airtime, but in the end, there is a balance between caring for people you love and every conceivable intervention. Thank you very much for your show. Just reacting to that last line, Frank, I think that there's a point, and we talked about that last week, I think very clearly, when you need to flip the switch between quantity of life and quality of life. And things that extend your life at the expense of making you uncomfortable are simply off the table at some point and need to be off the table. Your father has a disease which is progressive, I'm assuming it's emphysema, and irreversible. At some point, he will become so uncomfortable that it makes no sense at all to do anything to prolong his life, and what we do at that point is try to reduce his discomfort. But he's not there yet. The intervention that you refer to, nebulized N-acetylcysteine, is a reasonable thing to do. I would also say that many alternative practitioners use nebulized glutathione, which is closer to what you're after. Glutathione is a free radical sink. It's an antioxidant, and it also helps the mitochondria function. So in a situation where there's been a lot of oxidative stress, like in a chronic inflammatory disease like emphysema, reducing further oxidative stress not only helps with preventing further damage, but it actually restores some function to the energy-generating cells, and that can be a really good thing. When glutathione is nebulized and inhaled, it's able to cross into the bloodstream. It can also be given intravenously. It cannot be ingested orally. N-acetylcysteine, on the other hand, can be taken orally, and when taken orally, is probably, and I want to emphasize probably, helpful at improving glutathione levels in individuals. If I were treating your father with alternative methods, I would consider the inhaled glutathione, and that has a research literature in the cystic fibrosis world, and I think in the cystic fibrosis world has been shown to help prevent progressive damage, which we would otherwise see with cystic fibrosis. It's available with a doctor's prescription through compounding pharmacies. If your father is Kaiser, I think you will not be able to get that done through Kaiser. You're going to have to go outside the system and pay a doctor to evaluate him and write that prescription and monitor it, because it's not conventional medicine. And what you've got with Kaiser is very good, state-of-the-art, well-thought-out conventional medicine, but they don't go alternative. So I hope that's been helpful for you. And for other people who are considering ways of raising glutathione, I do think that this is a safer way to go, in my opinion, than giving it intravenously. I really just don't like bypassing that barrier unless I'm absolutely back to the wall, have to do it. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope that you will continue to send me such wonderful and interesting emails, as well as calling into the program with such intelligent questions. I love you, my audience, and I hope you'll stay with me long term. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.